Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, September 15, 2014, and what a great show we have for you today. I can't emphasize this enough. This one you got to sit down and listen to. And my thanks to whoever it was who said you should have Michael Malice on your show to talk about his book, Dear Reader, The Unauthorized Autobiography of Kim Jong-il. This guy, I didn't know anything about him. I mean, I'm completely out of the loop. I don't know how I did not know about Michael Malice, who is also a celebrity ghostwriter. Well, I'm going to have him explain to us exactly who he is, but you can see him frequently on The Independents on the Fox Business Network. So, wasting no further time, let's go right over to Michael Malice. Michael, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You know, I was telling you before we went on that I'm sorry to say I was unfamiliar with your work until a good listener alerted me. I always tell people I get some of my best suggestions from the listeners. So I looked you up and I thought, who is this guy? Right? I'm looking at all your work. Somebody's actually written a book about you. Like, who in the world are you? So before we even get into Dear Reader, the book I want to talk about, I demand that you account for yourself, man. Who the heck are you?
Well, I've been in Galt's Gulch this whole time. Sorry you weren't invited, Tom.
That's right. Apparently not. I thought I was one of the cool people, but I guess not.
Nope. You're going to have to keep being a janitor for a bit. I am by trade a celebrity ghostwriter. I write books for celebrities, but I've had a book written about me by Harvey Pekar. Harvey is the creator of American Splendor. He passed away 4 years ago. And the book is called Ego and Hubris. Laissez-faire Books carried it. They gave it a great review. They said, you know, Michael Malice is the hero of his own life. I've gotten some negative reviews. The Onion called me a human cockroach, which is a testament to my indestructibility as well as perhaps to my bad nature. But that's basically the, and I've been, you know, a hardcore involved in the Liberty Movement since college. And, trivia question, I own Ayn Rand's copy of The Fountainhead.
How did you get that?
During my 21st birthday was coming up, and there's a website called Paper Tiger, and the guy worked closely with her estate, and he was releasing some of her library books from her personal library, and I just emailed him wondering what else was coming up, and that was one of them. So my mom snagged it for me for my 21st birthday, so I'll be buried with it.
Well, that is that's a very, very unusual and interesting thing to have. Now,
wait, one more thing. Yeah. Sorry, I just remember this. And I have a copy of Atlas Shrugged signed by William F. Buckley, which I got personally signed.
Wow, and of course, my listeners will know that National Review absolutely trashed that book in its review. Yeah. Oh, they accused her. They said that her tone is that of a concentration camp. Guard, you know, to the ovens, go. They
claim
the gas
to
chamber.
A gas chamber go.
A gas chamber go. That's right. Yeah, even worse.
And when she died, William F. Buckley, the you know embodiment of class, the obituary said Ayn Rand is dead, and so is her philosophy. And yet here we are 30 years later, and her philosophy and what she you know would have brought forth is very much alive. Well, and him and his you know disgustingness, you know, is not.
Well, it's interesting that there's no real interest in the work of Bill Buckley anymore. Nobody's reading his books. Nobody's reading God and Man at Yale. I mean, I used to like the pose. For example, he used to have these debates, 3-on-3, on public television. This was one thing that I liked, because he would have one actor and then two sort of qualified people on each team, and they would go at each other. And I recommended to the producer of Judge Napolitano's old show on Fox Business, Freedom Watch, I said, if you brought that back and had a foreign policy debate between interventionists and non-interventionists, everyone would watch. And they never even got back to me. Like, that was a good idea. I'm sorry, that was a good idea. Or, you know what, I feel like I don't even want to talk about your book. I want to talk about you, but I do want to talk about your book. I want to know, though, one last thing. I've done some ghost writing for a couple of people. But how does somebody get that as a gig? To be a celebrity ghostwriter seems like a pretty hard thing to land.
It is, and you know, it was a series of fortuitous circumstances. Basically, I I had an editor who was familiar with Ego and Hubris, and he had a book proposal of mine to do a book. And that data couldn't make an offer on it, and he said, we're doing a book that's too similar. And he said, I talked to my editorial board, and I said, hey, don't you want to sell both Coke and Pepsi and leave RC Cola for somebody else? And they said no. So they said, well, what I want you to do is I want to bring you on to write that other book, and I want to get rid of that writer. He couldn't do that, and then he goes, hey, would you be interested in doing a memoir? And I said, sure. And he said, here's the thing. The guy's a Christian, not ironically. And I said, that's great. You know, when I was in college, many of my good friends are Christians, wonderful people. What's the problem? And then I'm like, who is it? And he goes, it's Ultimate Fighting Champion Matt Hughes. And then I got worried because he's a super jock and a farm boy. And I did not, you know, I'm an urban, you know, Jewish kid, intellectual. I didn't know that I had anything in common with him. And we became great, great friends. And once you have that first one, you know, you're kind of in the system, it's a lot easier. And I, because of the Fountainhead, my name is always on all my books. So I'm not even technically a ghostwriter, it's more co-author.
Yeah, that's right, because I was looking at the books on your site, and yet your name is indeed on them, whereas mine isn't, but I'm glad, because I don't want the people I'm writing for to have to deal with all my baggage. You know, they have enough problems. All right, so now, though, we're talking about your book that's more or less ghostwritten. I mean, there's a conceit to it. Give us the premise of Dear Reader.
So Dear Reader is the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. It's the world's first unauthorized autobiography. I've invented a new genre for this great, great man. So what I did is, you know, the usual ghostwriting process is, you know, you sit down with the client, you work together, and you create a narrative based on their life. In this case, you know, Kim Jong-il was not available to me. A, I'm not Korean. B, he's deceased. So I went to North Korea, and I got all the books that they have for sale here, and I read the entire Western library of books, and I adapted that into his life story told from his perspective.
So let's talk about some of that life story. Just at the very beginning, when we read about his birth and the circumstances of his birth, he's describing, or you're describing through him, I don't know quite how to put it, but he's describing interesting natural phenomena that just happened to be occurring at the moment of his birth.
Well, it wasn't just happened to be occurring. I mean, according to the North Korean mythology and propaganda, he was a miracle child sent from heaven. They refer to him in these terms, even though North Korea is explicitly atheist. And this is kind of to show that, you know, he's been chosen to follow the lead of his father, the great leader Kim Il-sung.
Now, when you were reading through some of these works that you got in North Korea, did you, in fact, detect a kind of a religious tone running through the portrayal of this man?
It's very, very intentional and conscious that there is a religious subtext to the North Korean literature. And this is why, you know, currently there's many refugees that go to China because the border has become porous between North Korea and China. And when they come back and they're smuggling things, they get kind of a slap on the wrist. However, if they have Bibles on them, or they are found to have talked even to a Christian in China, they're given the death penalty. So they are very, very atheistic in the sense that this is competition for them, because they have very consciously established a national religion. They talk about, you know, they have a Holy Trinity. They have Kim Il-sung, the great leader, is the father. They have Kim Jong-il's mother, anti-Japanese heroine Kim Jong-suk, and she's always referred to as anti-Japanese heroine. And Kim Jong-il is, you know, the Christ figure. He's this, you know, beautiful baby boy born on Mount Paektu, which is kind of their Mount Zion at the very north of Korea. Although in actuality, he was born in Russia, but according to them, you know, he was born at the top of this mountain, and the weather changed, and the ice on top of Lake Chon cracked, and there was a new star in the heavens, and everyone in Korea just kind of lost their minds with happiness when this beautiful day occurred.
I want to continue with the book in just a minute, but I can't help asking, when you were in North Korea, were you able to talk to people about the government? Could people speak freely? Were they suspicious of you? Did they think you were some kind of an agent? Did you talk to people?
You know, anyone who goes to North Korea comes, you have a guide with you the whole time. And what I did is, I didn't drink I'm not a big drinker anyway. I didn't have one drop of alcohol the entire time because I wanted to be very, very on and figure out what was real and what was staged. And I wanted to break my guide. I wanted to get through to her to figure out what she really thought.
Wow.
Now, I was born in the Soviet Union, so I know all these little tricks that, you know, you use when you're in living in a surveillance state. I grew up in a Russian household, so, you know, I just kind of through osmosis picked up what my parents and my grandparents know how to do. And using my ghostwriting techniques, which is when I try to break down someone's facade, because every celebrity has their kind of PR answer. But when you're writing a book, you want to get to know them as a real person and have some new information. So I kind of, you know, I tried to kind of establish trust and let her feel safe, and she got drunk one night. And one of the things I was telling her about, and this was a very, very telling moment, and I'll never forget it. It was chilling in retrospect. I was telling her, you know, she reminded me, which was true, a lot of my mom. And like seeing her and how she lived in North Korea told me what my mom had to have gone through living in the Soviet Union in the 50s. And she looks at me and she goes, well, then your mother must have hated Russia. And wow. She just kind of, and that's such a telling thing to say, and a kind of dangerous thing to say in a sense. But they, especially the guides, people who have interaction with the West, they know this is all baloney and nonsense. I mean, the bigger the lie, the harder it is to maintain. And they're told so much nonsense about the first family in North Korea that, you know, if you have any level of even intelligence, you're going to realize this is absurd.
The regime is so anomalous these days. And particularly yes. When you see the South Koreans, prosperous, intelligent, hardworking, you know, obviously the North Koreans are the same people. They've got the same characteristics, and yet they're stuck in this regime. Is there any crack in the facade? Is there any prospect of anything changing?
Well, one of the things I'll say is the fact that they are anomalous is to them an enormous source of pride. When I was working on Dear Reader, I was wondering, how do I get Kim Jong-il to talk about things that perhaps he would prefer to have swept in the rug? Because I would need in the book, but if I'm going to have this, you know, conceit that this is his autobiography, he would prefer not to talk about certain things. And what I was terrified to discover is they gloat about all these atrocities and horrors that they put on their people. Because when you're doing things in the name of the masses, you can allow yourself any horror, and no one's going to challenge you on it. So that was very, very scary. So the fact that they're the only ones left, this is great. That means they won, right? Everyone else did communism or statism wrong. They're the ones doing it right despite decades of outrage. And in fact, they regard the South as being corrupted by American blood. North Korea is the most racist nation on earth. It is the most homogenous nation on earth. Despite their communist pretenses, they are far, far closer to fascism in every sense. In fact, I have a line in the book, which is very ironic, where Kim Jong-il says, the dear leader is nothing like the Führer. Well, you know, Mussolini was called Il Duce, and Duce means leader. So it's very, very much fascist in its affectations, in its xenophobia, and its militarism, other than in an economic sense. But you know, it's the textbook kind of fascist, you know, ideology and worldview. Now, is there any cracks in the nation? Now, this is a question I get asked all the time. I was just in Prague last month, and I read this wonderful book called Revolution 1989, and it talks about how the Eastern Bloc fell away, and how when Gorbachev took his hand off the trigger, all these countries just very quickly became free, and they thought it was a trap. And I was reading this book with tears in my eyes because it's such a beautiful thing that you hear one country after another, you know, either the government's like, all right, we give up, this is nonsense, or there was some old man in power who had to have, you know, be pried away from office. And by the end, they're all free, and it's just this great thing. So, I mean, there's two steps. One is you have to have this huge culture of cynicism. You have to have people not believing the hype. And the second one is, you know, there has to be some kind of I'd say safety net in place, because the metaphor I always use is, look what happened to the slaves after the Civil War. Yes, ostensibly they were free, but these people had a hellish life for decades.
Let's go back into history. The key event, or a key event we'd want to talk about, is of course the Korean War, which is
yes.
viewed very differently in the West from how your subject would view it.
Yeah, the Fatherland Liberation War, they call it. One of the points that Kim Jong-il makes and North Korea makes, which is true, is that the Korean War in the West is swept in the rug. I mean, we refer to it very frequently here as the Forgotten War, whereas there, this is their kind of creation myth. This is how North Korea became a nation. According to them, it's, and the title of the book, called The U.S. Imperialists Started the Korean War. And one of the things Kim Jong-il, by the way, always insisted on in their literature and their propaganda is you can't say American, you have to say U.S. imperialist or Jap devil. You have to have some pejorative attached. So even the language is being used as a technique in very Orwellian terms to teach people to hate the Americans and the Japanese. So according to them, you know, the U.S. imperialists have been waiting to conquer Korea since like the 1860s. Yeah, and some of these references they make, I think they make up, and then I look on Google and they're true. The U.S. in 1860 sent General Sherman to Korea to kind of this little ship, and they took everyone on board, killed them, and sank it to the bottom of the ocean. Now, this is some kind of minor trade ship, but according to them, this was the U.S. imperialist's first feint to try to conquer Korea, and they've been, you know, kind of rubbing their hands ever since. There's this treaty with President Taft that they make these references to from 1904. But so we've been waiting, and then, you know, the moment came in the 50s to invade, and the great leader Kim Il-sung beat the U.S. imperialists back, and then, you know, the battle went back and forth, and he succeeded, from their perspective, in a great victory in kicking the Americans out of the northern half of the republic, as they refer to it. And they always refer to Korea as one country. That's why when they have North or South Korea, they will keep the N or the S lowercase, because the South is an occupied regime by the U.S. imperialists, whereas North Korea is the free part.
I don't really know how to respond to that. I mean, I assume that was how they interpreted it, but I mean, honestly, to think of the South that way and then look at the North as if this is the I don't know. Now, what does he does he have anything to say about Stalin's role in green lighting the northern invasion?
No. So this is what's great. First of all, there was this big argument between, I think it was Mao or Deng Xiaoping and Kim Il-sung at one point, because North Korea for decades played Russia and China against each other to get aid, and North Korea was in a literal sense of welfare state. They were living due to the welfare of these other larger nations. And at one point, China was so ticked off at North Korea that they put on display in one of their museums this letter from Kim Il-sung begging Stalin or Mao for help during the Korean War. No, according to them, Kim Il-sung pretty much did it single-handedly. There are sometimes references to that the Stalin helped enormously or Mao helped enormously, but those are increasingly kind of hidden as much as possible. In fact, the North Korean people aren't even taught about World War II. They're talking about the Pacific War, and they're taught that it's a function of Kim Il-sung driving the wicked Jap devils out of North Korea, because the idea that the Americans and the Japanese were at war with each other does not fit into the narrative, because those two nations have been colluding to conquer Korea for centuries. And in fact, they don't even teach them about Hiroshima or Nagasaki there.
Say that again?
They don't teach them about Hiroshima or Nagasaki. My guide had a vague awareness of the Holocaust. These are not things, because again, you know, if you go to any school in the States, you're going to have on the map an atlas of the world. You're going to have all the countries, you know, it's there. You don't have that in North Korea. You have a map of Korea. And I spoke to refugees, and they said the only countries that they're taught about are Japan, China, Russia, Korea, the United States, and maybe there's one or two more. But that's it. That's where your world begins and ends, and the rest of the world exists, but you don't really care about it.
You know, I've heard from one or two people that one of the many factors that led to undermining the communist regimes in Eastern Europe was the VCR, was that people could get evidence of what life was like outside their crummy part of the world, and that was a major ingredient in getting them to rethink the way they lived. Well, likewise, with the internet is like the VCR, you know, to the zillionth power. Are they keeping the internet completely out of North Korea?
Well, let's talk to this, because it's a very, very key point. North Korea, they don't really have electricity. So except in Pyongyang, and if you look at that, it's a very famous picture of the Korean Peninsula at night, take it from space, and the northern half is jet black, and the southern half, including Seoul, is all lit up. So there's less than 100 people in the whole country who are allowed on the internet. Even if people had computers, they really wouldn't be able to plug them in anywhere. But the same phenomenon with these VCRs is happening in the north, because many people have contact with the South or have contact in China. Now, China obviously is not a free nation, but compared to North Korea, their information is enormously free. I was in China, you know, and I went to an Apple store and I went to the internet, and maybe I can't learn about Tiananmen Square, but pretty much anything else I can look up and it'll be fine. So North Korea, you know, one of the things I'm fighting with Dear Reader and in giving these talks is that they're not crazy. They're actually very conniving and clever, and they're addressing this criticism. So as the North Korean population is understanding that the South is wealthier than they are, the propaganda has changed, and now the propaganda has changed. We're keeping Koreanists pure, whereas the South might have more money, but it's the money of prostitutes giving up their chastity to the U.S. rapist.
All right. Now, back on planet Earth, you must have, going into this project, you must have known that there was going to be a lot of creepiness, that you were going to be writing things that were going to seem completely bizarre to the Western reader. But at the same time, there must have been things that surprised you, that you weren't expecting at all, that just came completely out of left field. Can you share one or two of those with us?
Well, a lot of the things that you know, there are these casual references that they make that are just absolutely hilarious as asides. And one, you know, people always ask me, oh, the thing I'm fighting as well, Westerners, you know, view Kim Jong-il as this kind of clown figure, and they are aware of these wacky stories. And I always say, Kim Jong-il is like the Batman villain, the Joker. Yes, he is a clown, but if you look just past that clown, you have many, many bodies. And the focus shouldn't be on his clown makeup. It should be on the corpses that are there and that still remain there. So I'll tell you, one of the funny stories is, you know, Kim Jong-il is in high school, and his teacher comes and gives a guest lecture about the Mona Lisa and how great it is. And this goes on at length, this story. And Kim Jong-il gets up and starts berating him that the Mona Lisa is not a masterpiece and it's not good art and you should be ashamed of yourself. And I went home and I asked my mom, I go, Mom, why does Kim Jong-il hate the Mona Lisa? My mom, who had her good Soviet education, thinks for just 2 seconds and goes, because it's ambiguous. And that's exactly correct. The Mona Lisa has a cryptic smile, and therefore it's not good art, because the only purpose of art is propaganda and putting forth a lesson that everyone can understand. And the point of this propaganda, of course, clearly has to be the glorification of the great leader Kim Il-sung. And they stick this with a straight face. So that's just absolutely amazing. And there's another great story, which is an inversion. So they talk about how Kim Jong-il can shrink time. And actually, it's factual. He can't shrink time. He is at a conference, and he's signing documents, and he's getting interrupted by his aides, and he's hearing a speaker at the same time, and the speaker keeps stopping. And Kim Jong-il goes, why do you keep stopping? And the speaker goes, well, you're doing all these other things at once. And he goes, I can do 3 things at once. And then the literature says, from that point on, it was understood that Kim Jong-il didn't look at time as a plane, but as a cube. And I told this to my friend, and she goes, does he mean multitasking? And yes, that is exactly what he means by shrinking time. He could do more than one thing at once. And apparently, he's the only person in North Korea capable of doing this. So it's a good thing he's in the leadership position,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Of all people we could have, might as well be that guy. What an interesting look into the totalitarian mind. That Mona Lisa example really does speak volumes. Michael, if people want to follow you online, I suppose michaelmalice.com is the place to start?
Sure, I'm mostly on Facebook more than Twitter, but facebook.com/MichaelMalice.
Yeah, you know what, I am too, and even though Facebook annoys me with their algorithm that they use to decide whether your Facebook page posts get into people's feeds, nevertheless, I have twice as many people on my Facebook as I do on Twitter, but I get like 100 times the response on Facebook that I get on Twitter. Like, what's the?
Oh yeah.
I don't get. I mean, I'm on Twitter just by default. I feel like I need to be there. I want people to visit you, and I want you to come back. I mean, think of something else we can talk about, because I want people to read Dear Reader. I gave them the whole title at the beginning. I want them to visit michaelmalice.com, but there's got to be more we can talk about, because I have a feeling that we could just talk for an hour about almost nothing, and it would be interesting.
Well, one of the things that actually I'm on the Independence like every week now, and they had the same question, and the answer is I'm in a position to discuss how narratives and propaganda are used in the States, because the parallels are, to use Leonard Peikoff's term, ominous. It's, you know, when Hillary Clinton is on stage, she's using the same techniques that they use in the North to create this kind of secular mythology about herself. And, you know, I heard Yaron Brook give a talk about, you know, everyone's convinced about intellectually that capitalism is superior. Why haven't we won? The argument is it's not a battle of statistics. Statistics don't change anyone's mind. It's a battle of narratives. So that's something I'm really kind of interested about, and I think that's something that not that many libertarians are aware of or can have wrapped their heads around, maybe because so many of us have autism.
I think because so many of us, frankly, when I say us, you know, present company excluded, but I mean, I think so many people have absorbed some of these preconceptions, they don't realize they have them. For instance, Gene Healy at the Cato Institute has a book on the cult of the presidency. Now, that's very important. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's not going to be like Kim Jong-il. It's going to be a little bit more subtle than that, but a lot of these premises, the very fact that I know that the president is playing golf should be creepy to me. Why should I know his every or what his wife likes to eat for dinner? This is weird. I shouldn't care about this.
And that was one of the broader reasons why I wrote North Korea. I brought to your reader is everyone uses Atlas and the Sound Head as these kind of introductory texts, and I don't agree with everything Rand says. But the point I always make is she doesn't have all the answers, but she has all the questions. And, you know, she gets people thinking about things in a certain way, and once they're there, you know, they're kind of almost saved. But that book is 6 years old. I'm like, I thought we need more of these kind of narratives and stories that people can use as introductory texts to get them interested in free market and libertarian ideals. And everyone is a libertarian vis-a-vis North Korea. So my broader motive, other than having libertarians and everyone else engage with what's happened in North Korea and hopefully moving the needle there a little bit, is to get people to discover this movement a little further and think about these things a little clearer.
Exactly. It's easy to be opposed to this phenomenon in its most clownish form.
Right.
But it's a little bit more difficult to peel back layers of the onion and see that, you know, maybe 10% you kind of absorbed yourself. You believe in yourself in the way you show reverence toward the president. I'll just say one last thing. The other day I was in a group of people, not all of whom agreed with me, and we were talking about Barack Obama. None of them liked Obama, and one of them was saying, well, at least I respect the office. I try to have respect for the office. And I'm just sick and tired of this. I said, you know what? I don't even respect the office. I'm just going to come right out and say that. I don't even respect the office. Because once you start speaking in language like that, the creepiness and cultishness inevitably follows. Well, Michael Malice, thanks so much for your time today. If only all guests could be like Michael Malice. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, everybody. That was Michael Malice. I'm telling you, doesn't this show just get better and better? Like, it's been almost a year since we've been doing a Monday through Friday show, and I keep thinking, well, eventually the quality is just going to have to drop off, and it just never does. I'm so pleased to be able to have so many great guests on this show. So if you're not subscribing already, come on, don't make me smack you in the head. Go over to TomWoodsRadio.com. We've got easy subscription links on iTunes and Stitcher. Get your commute-sized chunk of Liberty education every weekday. And if that's not enough liberty education for you, if you really want to learn stuff, you want to learn the American history and the European history you weren't taught in school, you want to learn economics of a sort you weren't taught in school, you want to hear the liberty message, then my Liberty Classroom is for you. LibertyClassroom.com is where you can get courses taught in these subjects where you know we should have learned it this way, but we didn't. And they're taught by people that I trust, including myself. And you can take 50% off with coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps over at libertyclassroom.com. You can be that guy people go to and say, I'm stumped. I don't know what to say about such and such argument. And you can just say, well, 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 here is the answer. libertyclassroom.com, check that out. Subscribe to the show because another week of programming begins on Monday. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.